Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Oncology Grand Rounds, as today we talk about new agents and strategies in the management of lymphomas, non-Hodgkin lymphoma and Hodgkin lymphoma. And before we start to go through our agenda here tonight, just to give you sort of a macro view in a second, I'm just going to ask for the faculty's global thoughts about this, but so many new agents now coming in oncology, being approved, coming into practice, new treatment strategies. And here are seven that we're going to be talking about tonight, just in lymphomas, all types of different strategies, antibody drug conjugates, immunotherapy, small molecules, et cetera. And here's the way it's going to play out. In the agenda, we're going to start out talking about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. In each one of these, we're going to emphasize kind of what's new. So we're going to talk a lot about CAR T therapy and also polatuzumab vedotin, the antibody drug conjugate. We're also going to talk about BV and Hodgkin lymphoma, but also immunotherapy. And you can see down the line, if we have time at the end, we're going to chat a little bit about managing lymphomas in the era of COVID-19. So before we get started, I just want to take a breath now and kind of put everything in perspective. We'll bring the faculty up here and just kind of curious. I'll start out with you, Craig Moskowitz. I'm curious how it's been to see all these new therapies coming into lymphomas. You've been involved with this for a while. You were at Memorial Sloan Kettering before. What's it been like to see so many new treatments come into the field, Craig?
So in general, when I do a consult, especially in patients with relapsed disease, I almost always say that almost all newer treatments are better than all older treatments. And if they're not better, they're less toxic. So that's usually my go-to line. It also helps with research studies, but the era of down and dirty chemotherapy, especially for the indolent lymphomas, it's almost gone. And I'm happy about it.
Curious, Molly, also for your perspective, you've been involved with this field, you know, sort of the chemo days, so to speak. What it's been like for you to see agents like BTK inhibitors come in and really these small molecules revolutionize what we're doing? Any comments, Molly?
It's really a different kind of world. The side effect profiles are so much tighter than in traditional chemotherapy. So the therapies are very well tolerated. The patients have a lot of independence because they don't have to come here to the clinic so frequently. Things have really changed, and some of the newer antibodies and the conjugates have really added up to more success. Again, tighter side effect profiles. It's really a different world than when I started. I'm not saying how many years ago, Neil, but like you said, the chemotherapy is not in the forefront, and so that's a great thing.
We're going to start out talking about diffuse large B-cell. What we're going to do for each one of these modules is we're going to chat a little bit about the disease, the oncology strategy, and then we're going to hear about a patient from one of the nurses and see how this plays out in real life, so to speak. We could talk about diffuse large B-cell for a long time, but we're just going to focus on some new things, in particular the use of the new antibody drug conjugate polatuzumab vedotin, as well as CAR T therapy. Such an exciting time right now. We'll reflect back too. Also, the ASCO meeting was last week, and I'll find out whether there's anything there that was of any great note. We'll start out talking a little bit about polatuzumab, and I'll start with you, Mike, because it's interesting. This is an antibody drug conjugate, sort of like bevacizumab, but it's given in combination with chemotherapy, usually BR. And Mike, maybe you can talk a little bit about when you think about using polatuzumab and kind of what your experience is when you give it to patients.
Yeah, so it's, as you mentioned earlier, one of the newer agents that we have, and it's proven to be quite valuable in a couple of settings in particular for our practice right now. And that one of the main ones is people who have relapsed, and we are trying to relapse with their large cell, and we're trying to bridge them to either a stem cell transplant or CAR T. And it takes time to develop and plan for those. You have to collect stem cells. If it's a CAR T, you have to get the cells processed. That can take 3 to even 4 weeks. And so, as you know, with relapsed large cell lymphoma, the disease can progress rapidly. And so you can't let the disease outrun you while you're getting things ready for this next line of treatment. So how you bridge those patients and get their disease back under control so you have as low a burden of disease as possible when they go into treatment is very important. And so the combination of polatuzumab with BR has proven to be one of the active regimens that we can use for that purpose, because sometimes these people are refractory to some of the other chemotherapies that they've had. And so it gives you a more novel way to target the lymphoma cells and try to maintain control while you're getting them geared up for what we hope will put them into a durable remission.
So I'm going to ask Kim in a second to talk about kind of what you say when you are about to begin a patient on polatuzumab. I know you have a patient actually that we're going to present who received it. But first, Craig, can you backtrack a little bit and talk about how polatuzumab works? It's a so-called antibody drug conjugate. Last week in our breast cancer program, we were talking about three antibody drug conjugates, T-DM1, sacituzumab. So can you talk a little bit about how antibody drug conjugates work, Craig, and what this one is?
So these are fairly, at this particular point, they're not novel anymore because brentuximab has been around for almost 10 or 11 years. But basically, it's an antibody that binds to a target. We call that an antigen. In this particular case, it's CD79B. I think of it almost like a syringe. Once it binds to the cell surface, a chemotherapy prodrug is injected inside the cell. It's enzymatically cleaved, and an active agent is then released internally, and it can kill the cell. The most common of these is MMAE, which is monomethyl auristatin E, which for all intents and purposes is sort of like vincristine with a little bit less side effects. And this is a MMAE is also the chemotherapy prodrug, which is used in brentuximab vedotin. This particular CD79B is a very, very good target in lymphoma. Almost all B-cell lymphoma is expressed CD79B. I actually foresee polatuzumab being used in not just only diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, but some of the other lymphomas as well, as it's studied a little bit more broadly. One of the things that Mike had said that he uses this as a bridge to CAR T-cells, I actually give this treatment, and I hope it's going to achieve a complete response. Because if you look at the curves in the patients who are on the clinical trials that I think that you all have, patients who actually achieve a complete response, they may not relapse. Almost a quarter of the patients who have a complete response have still not relapsed with polatuzumab-based treatment, which is almost unheard of in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma.
So yeah, that is really interesting. And we know that actually polatuzumab, although as we talked about, it's being used in the relapse setting, either as a treatment, but also in patients who just to sort of bridge them to transplant. It's actually being looked at in a trial right now up front. And if we can put that slide on there, this is the POLARIX study. We'll see when this gets reported. So it's possible that rather than giving R-CHOP in the future, and we're going to talk about what happened in Hodgkin, it kind of reminds me a little bit there, you're going to be given this antibody drug conjugate with RCHP. And Kim, you know, I guess the cool thing about these antibody drug conjugates is you're delivering chemotherapy, but it's really going like a Trojan horse into the cancer cell. Do you see many chemotherapy systemic effects, hair loss, nausea, and vomiting, Kim?
No, typically you don't see any. That's the nice thing about it, which I always try to remind people, it's not really chemo in that it's targeted. So they don't have to worry about hair loss or nausea or vomiting. You just have to worry more about the side effects of initial reactions, fever, chills. And we don't use it that often here, but anaphylactic type reactions, we pre-med them and then discuss it can affect the blood counts, especially this drug particularly can. And this drug also, it seems like, can also cause diarrhea. So we talk about bowel management and fatigue. And neuropathy apparently is another side effect of this drug. So this patient in particular we're going to talk about, she's had a lot of therapy, so we have to be more mindful of it, adding another agent that can cause the neuropathy. But I do emphasize that it's not like traditional chemotherapy, which is nice. And then we talk about when your initial visit, if they have any bulky disease, tumor lysis, and monitoring fluids, monitoring electrolytes, and just kind of review each side effect that potentially could happen with the initial visit and then the following visits.
So Molly, you know, we're going to shift our discussion into CAR T therapy, at least as it relates to diffuse large B cell. We're actually doing an entire webinar, I think in a few weeks, on CAR T therapy in different diseases. But I'm just curious for your perspective on this. We put this question in here. You know, diffuse large B cell, most of the time when people relapse, and you know, we can ask Craig to comment on this in a second, they're going to go for an autologous transplant. But then after that, there hadn't been very many options, and now we have CAR T therapy. One of the questions, Molly, is what kind of shape does somebody need to be in to go through CAR T? You're not getting high dose chemotherapy as you do in an autologous transplant. Any reflections, Molly, on what you've seen so far with CAR T and what toll it takes on patients compared to something like transplant?
Yeah, I actually have a patient right now. She has diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and she just had a PET scan today, and she's not having any improvement, so they're moving her to CAR T to start her harvest and everything on Friday. And normally when I think about patients who are going to an allo transplant, I think of a performance status of 1 or 0 and in top shape and the least amount of disease and the least amount of chemotherapy. And with CAR T, that doesn't seem to be necessarily the prerequisites, and that patients may have more side effects from their disease because you can move them more quickly into CAR T as you can get products available. And so they may have a little bit more symptoms, I guess, would be the right word for it. So, and they tolerate it. They can tolerate a CAR T therapy regimen. And like you said, the whack of chemotherapy isn't there, so it's a bit easier to get through.
So in a second, I'm going to ask Mike to kind of go through how CAR T therapy is actually given. But Craig, can you just provide a brief overview of how patients who relapse, there's a pretty high cure rate, and you might want to comment on what the cure rate is when you give upfront R-CHOP, but then how you manage patients who relapse?
So in general, R-CHOP cures about 2/3 of the patients if you lump all the folks together. If you eliminate, I know this is going to sound terrible, but if you eliminate the 10% of the patients that we can never help, they're either too old, they got multiple problems, terrible pathology. So basically, we have about 1/4 of the patients that are left that were not cured and or could never be cured. Then you divide the patients into 2 categories, either they're transplant eligible or they're transplant ineligible. And you tend to treat patients on different pathways based upon, unfortunately, age and comorbidity and their underlying disease. So what I like to do is, and I have a position paper coming out in the JCO about this, is that I give everybody who is less than 72 salvage chemotherapy. Doesn't matter what it is. Whatever is your favorite salvage chemotherapy, you can give it. I tend to give outpatient salvage chemotherapy to patients who are older than 65 and inpatient less. If the patients have a very good response, and in fact, at ASCO last week, there was data presented from the CIBMTR registry that even patients with a partial response, still with a slightly abnormal PET scan, have a 41% cure rate with an auto transplant. So I give everybody salvage therapy, and if they're responding, I send them for an auto transplant. If they're not responding, or they have an inadequate response to salvage therapy, then I gear them up for CAR T cells, provided that they're age appropriate and that they don't have a lot of comorbidities. And I do exactly what Mike said. My knee-jerk response is to give the folks BR Pola and try to get the patients to CAR T cells. And I really try to put the patients on a clinical trial. And I know Mike will probably mention this as well, but it seems to me that every new CAR T cell construct is probably at worst equivalent to what we have right now. And we can talk about that later, but there's a lot of good ones that are coming down. There must be 20.
Well, we're going to spend an hour and a half on CAR T in a couple of weeks. So this is really just the tasting menu to really kind of get you interested and to come to the other one. But Mike, can you go through at a very brief and basic level the way you explain to a patient how CAR T works? And maybe we're going to show a couple of slides in terms of its efficacy and toxicity. And again, we want you to go back and take a look at the slides and think about them. We're just sort of cruising through them right now. So Mike, how do you explain to patients the way CAR T works?
Right. So this is an important discussion, obviously, when you're faced with someone who's got recurrent disease with their large cell, and what can we do to get them back in remission and hopefully cured. So with an auto transplant, as I think most everyone on the call knows, that's really relying on the fact that you're giving a very high dose of chemotherapy that is potentially lethally toxic, and you're rescuing that patient from the bone marrow suppression effects of high-dose chemo by giving them their own stem cells back that you've collected and stored. CAR T is completely different, and you have to think of it as an immunotherapy. So in this case, you're collecting T cells from patients. They go to a laboratory. where they are modified, they're reprogrammed genetically to target immunologically the lymphoma cells. So you expand them in the laboratory to get a large enough number of cells, and then they're shipped back to the site of the medical center or the hospital where they're going to be delivered, and then they're reinfused to the patient, and they will then home to and target the cells and create an immunologic response. It's in a way analogous to an allo transplant, not an auto, where you're really, you should think of it as a form of cellular immunotherapy. And there are some side effects that we can talk about, and I'm sure we'll get into a little bit with CAR T due to this, what can be a very vigorous immune response. But it's a very important, clever, and sophisticated way of delivering therapy to patients who, for many of them, until this came along, would have had no really good or meaningful treatment options that had a chance to put them into a deep remission.
And I guess, Mike, you know, the bottom line, we could take a look at a lot of the efficacy slides. You can take a look at the ones that we have in there. But the bottom line is this group of patients who otherwise really has no options, you have a significant number of them, very deep responses that seem to be going on for a long time. Do you think that some of these patients might be cured?
Well, I'd be interested to hear what Craig has to say about that. But as we get longer follow-up, there does seem to be a plateau, and a proportion of patients going out 2-3 years or more remain in remission without detectable disease. So we're hoping that, in fact, they are cured at that point.
So, I mean, just the fact that we see so many remissions and so deep, and we're even talking about cure, is really amazing. But let's just get a little bit of a snapshot of how this plays out in actual practice. And Kim, you had this 59-year-old lady. She presented with actually a big mass in her, she had a big mass in her ovaries. She had extranodal disease. She had multiple forms of therapy. I just want to really focus on what happened in last November. And at that point, she'd already relapsed after transplant and was going through the strategy that we've been talking about before of trying to get a response that can lead into getting CAR T therapy, which is exactly what happened. You talked before about some of the patient ed things in terms of polatuzumab, Kim. Anything else you want to say about this woman? Apparently, she now is in complete remission. I guess we'll see how long this lasts. But any sort of global comments about this case and the impact that CAR T therapy had? And also, I know you weren't actually managing her when she had the CAR T therapy, but what you heard in terms of the toxicities that she had.
So one of the biggest one of, you know, like with a lot of different patients, they'll have their own uniqueness about them. And one of hers is she had a lot of chronic pain from this mass in the ovary, which didn't seem to want to go away. I don't think it ever completely disappeared. And so after her autologous transplant, they re-imaged her and it was still present. So they did the polatuzumab with the Benda and then moved on to the CAR T. She had some social situations that we've talked about, not a lot of financial means and social support. So there were those added problems to her whole treatment situation. So after 2 doses of the polatuzumab, they re-imaged her and she was in complete remission. She went from a 5 to a 1 Duvel. And so then they started the CAR T process. She tolerated the treatment well, from what I understand, and didn't really have any serious side effects from the polatuzumab. So they re-imaged her. They did that in November and December, and then they re-imaged her in January and saw the remission. They collected her, I think, prior to the polatuzumab. Then they moved forward with the CAR T in February. She had some neurotoxicities. They called it the cytokine release syndrome, CRS, and she was treated with steroids and TOCI, and she had some, the neurotoxicity was confusion, altered mental status, and agitation, but that resolved on its own, and they did all this inpatient. They keep them inpatient here for about 2 weeks, and then all those symptoms resolved. She was discharged, and they re-imaged her in April, and she remains in remission. She's actually being managed locally, so she sees our stem cell people because of the transplant, and then she's managed locally by her local oncologist. And as far as I know, she's doing well. She still has chronic pain, even though she doesn't have disease there anymore. And she, as far as I know, has no current issues at all.
So we're going to move on and talk about Hodgkin lymphoma in a second. But Craig, just a final comment. And again, we urge you to look through the slides about the toxicities that are seen with CAR T, cytokine release, hypotension, fevers, et cetera. Kim was talking about tocilizumab, which can be used, and also these neurologic problems which this patient also had. Any comments on these? It seems, Craig, that these generally are transient. If you can kind of get the patient through that, they seem to do well. Is that what you understand?
Yeah, I think we have a handle on CRS. I think that originally we thought that this was going to be a big issue, but intensive care docs and bone marrow transplanters are well in tune to dealing with this. The neurotoxicity is still somewhat dicey and not necessarily predictable and can be delayed and sort of has to go away on its own, although there's some evidence that, you know, there might be some cytokines that can be used to help in that setting. I've seen in my patients that it's been reversible, but it is scary when it is happening. Just one comment about this case, Kim. This case is a miracle because in a patient who fails auto transplant less than 3 months after, the median survival of those patients are generally measured in days to weeks. So now you've got a patient in remission with a new drug, and now you're giving them another new thing. And I agree with Mike. I think that a quarter of these patients or a third of these patients are going to be cured. Mm-hmm. So it's cool.
Yeah, it is.
Super cool. Let's move on and talk about Hodgkin lymphoma. We had a cool question come in from the audience about the issue about you have to wait for the CAR T therapy. And actually, now we're starting to see off the shelf, there were some presented at ASCO, agents that can be used that have a similar mechanism. But again, tune into our CAR T show, so to speak, and we're going to get into a lot more depth there. But now we want to move into Hodgkin lymphoma, and particularly the use of brentuximab vedotin, particularly up front as a relatively new strategy, but also checkpoint inhibitors. And so we asked this question here. You know, we've known for a long time that you have standard ABVD, often risk adapted, but something beat that recently, and we all know what that is, which is the answer C, ABD and brentuximab vedotin. So again, Mike, if you can talk a little bit about what BV is, it kind of looks similar to what we were just talking about in terms of polatuzumab being an antibody-drug conjugate. And maybe talk a little bit about how it sort of worked its way into being used upfront in the treatment of extensive stage Hodgkin's.
Well, Craig did a nice job explaining the injectable, at a cellular level, the injection of the chemotherapy agent into the cell. It interferes with tubulin and microtubule formation, so cells, they die when they try to divide after this is in place. So it turns out that this was very active as a single agent in relapse refractory Hodgkin lymphoma. So it really was a big advance some years ago when it became available. And as with many of the drugs that we use in oncology that turn out to have value in the relapse refractory setting, they get moved more and more to the front line. And so there were various studies looking at whether you could use it by itself or in some combination as initial therapy. It turned out that in the initial phase one study, where there was an effort to just add brentuximab vedotin to traditional ABVD, that you can't give Brentux with bleomycin. There's too much pulmonary toxicity. So that's why the study that moved forward was a large phase three trial comparing standard ABVD with ABVD minus bleo, but adding in Brentux. And that is the one that showed some improvements in outcome, a little different side effect profile, but improvements in outcome for AAVD, which is the newer regimen. And that's now the control arm in the newer, the current ongoing phase three national study. So it's moved from being the experimental arm to the standard arm in the new study. And maybe it's going to be supplanted with what's being studied now. So that's the way we progress in the field.
So it does seem, you know, when you look at the trial that you were just talking about, the Echelon 1 trial, which, as you said, compared this strategy to the more traditional strategy, you did see a slight improvement. It wasn't gigantic, but it was a significant improvement. I think I hear a lot of people talking about this in higher risk situations, particularly younger patients. Also, we've seen BV used up front in T-cell lymphoma. This is the Echelon 2 study, where it was added up front to chemotherapy as well and also showed a benefit. Craig, any comments before we go into other issues related to bevedotin about the use of this strategy up front? There's been a lot of debate ever since it first came out. it looked like the results were better in North America with the idea that maybe the docs had more experience with the drug. Any comment about this strategy and what it really means to patients using it up front in this situation, Craig?
Well, the nurses will know that BV-ABD cannot be given without growth factors. Everybody is neutropenic, and then there'll be delays in therapy. So in the U.S., we knew about this, and patients were given prophylactic G-CSF, and we almost never dose reduced. So the data in North America, although it's a secondary analysis of the study, is 10% better than the data in Europe. That's number one. The second issue in the T-cell lymphoma study, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but I'm pretty sure that this is the only study in untreated lymphoma where there's a survival advantage, overall survival advantage of one arm versus another. It's unheard of in lymphoma.
Right, right.
So that ship has sailed. Everybody's given that for T-cell lymphoma that's CD30 positive.
That's Let's correct. Talk a little bit about the practical implications. And Molly, we've been using BV even prior to this in consolidation. And actually, Craig did the study where they looked at patients who had transplant after having a relapse, and they did better when they got BV consolidation over a year. I'm curious, Molly, on this experience, I'm sure you've given a lot of BV just to extensive stage disease, both in that setting where you're going to give it by itself, as well as in the upfront setting, you're going to present a patient. Just curious what you see in terms of tolerability with BV, particularly as it relates to neuropathy, Molly.
Yeah, neuropathy seems to be the most prominent of the side effects, and peripheral neuropathy can be life-altering, and that's something that we really want to pay attention to in these patients. Oftentimes, it doesn't recede, and that's something they're going to be working with or working against or dealing with for the remainder of their life. And if it gets bad enough, it can alter your livelihood. It can affect the way that you sleep and rest and function. And so it's not a great thing to have. You can have visceral neuropathies as well that can affect the way that your gut works and have other problems with that. And so we try to pay attention up front and dose adjust as we can. There are some studies that look at adding some supplements like B12. We certainly treat the pain with whatever combinations of medications that we can do. We consult pain service, we consult neurology, and try to see if maybe we can thwart off some of the side effects early on. Like I said, dose adjust and pay attention to what the patient's saying.
We're going to see how the strategy using AAVD upfront plays out in a patient that Molly has in a second. But I just want to bring one other topic up. And of course, this is a topic that we're going to deal with in almost every one of these symposia because checkpoint inhibitors right now are infiltrating into solid tumor medicine. But a really interesting story here, Craig, in terms of checkpoint inhibitors in Hodgkin lymphoma, where it seems like maybe Hodgkin might be the most responsive disease to checkpoint inhibitors. There's a really fascinating sort of observation kind of behind this in terms of the amplification of PD-L1. Craig, can you take a shot at explaining what goes on in Hodgkin lymphoma and how responsive it is to checkpoint inhibitors?
Well, sure, you are correct. You know, Hodgkin lymphoma is the king or queen of the response rate with checkpoint inhibitors, and we've been studying this now for a long time. It just so happens that the most common genetic abnormality in the Reed-Sternberg cell, which is the cancer cell in Hodgkin lymphoma, is an abnormality on chromosome 9p. And there are interesting things that live on chromosome 9p, including PD-1 and JAK, but PD-1 lives there. And it turns out that because of that, the checkpoint inhibitors, which as everybody knows who's listening, inhibit an inhibitory signal. I'm not going to say the word melts, but every single patient with Hodgkin lymphoma usually has some type of response, which can be seen on these waterfall plots. And I'm sure you've been familiar with these. Now, it's good to be on the bottom part of the waterfall plot as opposed to the top. And you can see with the two drugs that are approved in Hodgkin lymphoma, Pembro and Nivo, that almost every single patient responded. We still have patients getting nivolumab from the original phase 1 study, protocol 12282, so late 2012. They're still getting Nivo, and there are still patients getting Pembro from the original study in 2013. Are the patients cured? I don't know if they're cured, but without the drugs, they wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm. We're going to see how this actually plays out in a patient. But I think we should say, too, that I'm sure the obvious question is, what about using checkpoint inhibitors earlier? And we can talk about a lot of trials that are looking at that. And of course, it seems like that may be in the future. But before we may even comment on that, let's just get into the issue of how it plays out in practice. Molly, you have this young woman. Can you talk a little bit about her and particularly what happened when she first got treated?
Yes, she was a 31-year-old woman and had not an extensive period to figure out her diagnosis, but certainly a couple of months to try to figure out what was actually happening. Presented with shortness of breath and cough, got some antibiotics, got some steroids, had a CTPE after an ER presentation with worsening shortness of breath. No PE, couple of lymph nodes. They do a biopsy. They're non-diagnostic. A couple months later, she gets a skin rash that's biopsied as erythema nodosum. And then they repeat all of her scans and her lymph nodes have gotten worse. And so they finally get an excisional biopsy and she's diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease. And she gets all the staging workup, PET scan. She's got disease above and below the diaphragm. Everything's kind of lit up. And she gets treated initially with 6 cycles of AVD and BV. And a little bit about her socially is that she's a stylist, a hairdresser, and she's the sole breadwinner. She lives by herself. She's not married. She doesn't have kids. And one of the things that we worry about with, especially we talked about peripheral neuropathy, is that this is this woman's livelihood. And if she can't use her fingers or stand for long periods of time from the peripheral neuropathy, she's not going to be able to support herself. And so that becomes a difficult challenge. And so before we got started with therapy with her, we had long discussions about, you need to let us know right away. We need to act on it as quickly as we can. And so with every patient who receives any of these drugs, and certainly any treatment for Hodgkin's disease, 5 times before they get each therapy, someone asks them about their peripheral neuropathy. Someone says, are you having any numbness or tingling in your fingers or toes? And that's just a rote saying that everyone, from the minute they walk in and the nurses take their vital signs to the minute they get through infusion. So it's important to monitor them very quickly. And she actually had to have dose reduction of the BV early on, and then the vinblastine got reduced a couple of times and then eventually dropped at the end, and the benefit versus the risk of the neuropathy wasn't there. So she was able to maintain function. This is a picture of her PET scans before, it should say AVD and BV, and you can see that she's got clearly extensive disease above the diaphragm. She's got some stuff hanging out near her liver. Her bone marrow's all lit up. And then the second one is after she completes therapy. I think this is the final one. There's one in between that shows improvement. And so you can see that all of that disease has gone. And so she made it through very well with a terrific response, able to go back to work. One of the other things that we talked about in the beginning with a Hodgkin's disease patient, because of her age, is that we talked about fertility. And she decided that she didn't want to do any fertility preservation because she's single, although she doesn't have children. And it just wasn't the right time for her to, she was more interested in getting through chemotherapy and getting moving on the diagnosis. But we do consult the fertility service for all young patients who are of childbearing age before they get started on chemotherapy, particularly Hodgkin's disease, but any kind of chemotherapy that we're going to give.
So we're going to move on now, talk about follicular lymphoma. But Mike, any final comments if you've heard this case? Of course, she had a great response. It's not unusual in Hodgkin lymphoma. Hopefully, maybe a little bit more likely because of the regimen. Any comments about the case, Mike?
No, I think younger people, especially with higher risk disease, seem to benefit particularly from the AAVD regimen. I think the comments that have been made about the increased risk of cytopenias and need for growth factor, which we don't use with ABVD typically, and the neuropathy just needs a lot of close monitoring and management. And it's where I find that our infusion nurses often get information and hear things from patients that they may not tell me or they may not tell Kim, but the nurses know about it. So they're very much part of our monitoring of these patients when they're on study or on treatment.
Kim, any comments on the issue of fertility in younger patients with lymphoma in general, and including a situation like this, Kim?
The fertility piece, I mean, it's brought up typically in the beginning of the education of treatment. It's more focused more on like the leukemics who get different types of regimen for fear of the risk of disrupting their fertility. Usually, a lot of times, it's not usually a huge conversation that I'm aware of a choice of eggs and stuff, because a lot of people can have babies after ABVD. And I've seen people have babies, and we have actually several patients, they come back 2 or 3 years later with babies, one or two or three of them. They're always told ahead of time it may, but most of them have babies, especially in their 30s. I mean, I don't know what other people have experienced, but we have a lot of post-ABVD babies.
Once in a while, we get the during ABVD baby.
Yeah, that's how they get diagnosed.
Yeah.
So I will say that I put every female patient on Lupron.
Yep.
The other issue is that I leave it up to the patient about fertility. Mm-hmm. Now, this is much different than in large cell lymphoma, where in large cell lymphoma, I realize you don't talk about fertility all that much because the disease is percolating along. But for Hodgkin lymphoma, you know, there is time, especially if the patient's period is in sync with what we want to do. I collect a lot of eggs, I must say. And whatever the patient wants is okay with me.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Let's move on now, talk a little bit about follicular lymphoma. And we're going to talk about some new things that have developed in the field, including the use of the so-called R-squared regimen as upfront treatment, but also a new class of agents, PI3 kinase inhibitors. You might have remembered last week, we were talking about alpelisib in breast cancer, but different kind of PI3 kinase, totally different pathway, but similar and maybe a little bit similar toxicities. And just to get started, though, we put out this question, and we put these questions out to kind of get you thinking a little bit, so to test your own knowledge. So, Mike, we put out this question. Patients with advanced stage follicular lymphoma who are not experiencing symptoms may receive treatment with, and I'd say you could say either observation or maybe rituximab alone, but Mike, can you comment a little bit on the natural history? And we should mention all the faculty has done lectures that we're going to make you aware about. Mike went through a lot of these details in his lecture, but maybe you can just talk a little bit, Mike, about how you approach a newly diagnosed patient with follicular lymphoma, and particularly one that doesn't have any symptoms.
Right. So follicular lymphoma often will have a slow pace of disease. There's a real spectrum of patients with folliculars from very indolent, very low tumor burden to more actively progressing, high burden disease. But a patient who does not have any symptoms at all, you can legitimately recommend observation. So you can watch and wait, see them periodically, educate them about symptoms for which they should notify you. And it's going to mean you'll probably re-image them somewhere at 4 months, 6 months to get a sense of the pace of disease. But the discussion we have with patients, if they're asymptomatic, is whether they are comfortable with the observation and sort of monitoring, or do they feel like, gee, I just can't live with knowing I've got this and we're not doing anything about it. And so a reasonable option there, based on a study called the RESORT trial that is summarized in the slides that Neil mentioned, uses just 4 single doses of rituximab alone. And the response rates, at least in patients with low burden of disease, is about 70%, and about 30-35% are complete remissions, some of which are quite durable, even going out beyond 5 years with just 4 doses. So we have that discussion, and then we proceed basically with whatever the patient is comfortable with.
So Kim, you know, we're going to get into this discussion on Thursday as well when we talk about CLL, where patients usually present being asymptomatic and they're observed. Just kind of curious, Kim, how people, and Mike was talking about there's a spectrum of responses, how you respond to patients who say, hey, I've got this cancer, you know, I don't really like the idea of it not being treated. I guess, what's the spectrum of what you see, Kim, and how do you respond to it?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's in context to what the patient has been diagnosed with. I mean, the case study that I presented, I mean, she's a good example of somebody who had low-grade follicular and she percolated for 9 years. And I try to kind of focus the type of cancer. I try to have people look at it like a chronic disease because it is slow growing. And there's always seems to be, I mean, I've been doing this a really long time. So there's always a new treatment out there for them. And I try to have people focus on that it is like a chronic disease, and we'll treat the symptoms as they come up. If not, we'll just continue to monitor like we have been doing, and I redirect them that way. And a lot of people, I think after a while, get used to having the disease, and it's easier for them to manage on a day-to-day basis.
So Craig, that trial, the resort trial that actually Mike was the principal investigator of, one of the things about it was you know, how well people did just with four doses of rituximab. Mm-hmm. The fact, Craig, that they got chemotherapy later, it delayed the time that they get chemotherapy, but it still is giving a treatment as opposed to observation. And of course, nowadays, trying to keep people out of the hospital to start with. Any comments on this situation, Craig, and what'll drive you to say use rituximab as opposed to observe somebody?
So once again, this is one of these patient, physician, long Talmudic conversations that you're going to have. And and I think that, to me, I try to monitor everybody if I can. I will always say that monitoring a patient is more difficult than treating a patient. Mm-hmm. Knowing when to treat is the art in follicular lymphoma. I will say, though, that if you monitor a patient, and if you look at the data from most centers, you can usually do it anywhere from 3.5 to 4.5 years. Usually, you're going to give chemotherapy when the patient needs to be treated. All of a sudden, when you press that button, it's not going to be 4 weekly doses of rituximab. It's usually going to be something else. So you have to prepare the patients for that. I would say that many times we might sequence the patient. Not all follicular lymphoma is the same. However, once again, there's a lot of new drugs in follicular lymphoma. Chemotherapy is kind of moving down the road. R-CHOP, which used to be the most common regimen given in follicular lymphoma, you know, almost none of us give R-CHOP unless we think that there's an underlying transformed lymphoma these days. And we don't do that anymore, so we don't want to burn that bridge. So therapy has changed. I wrote an editorial in Blood in 2006 that the median, I'm old, so the median survival of follicular lymphoma had increased from 7 to 12 years in the previous decade. Probably, I think the median survival is probably close to 20 years now.
Wow.
For follicular lymphoma.
Amazing.
So, as you said, Kim, it really is a chronic disease. What I explain to the patient is I'd rather have follicular lymphoma than diabetes, quite frankly.
Correctly.
You just have to have that story. We all have that line down on how we want to talk about monitoring follicular lymphoma. So wow. It is an art.
Interesting. I like that diabetic one. So Molly, here's an interesting question we've been asking for the last couple of years, and I've been kind of surprised about this, which is sub-Q rituximab. I kind of figured like it was just everybody was going to do it, but I'm not so sure that's the case. What is your experience, Molly, with sub-Q rituximab?
It seemed as though it was in vogue for a while and then kind of went back by the wayside, and we really don't use much of it at all. We do rapid infusion rituximab, and so they're only here. It shortens the time to 1 hour for the infusion, so it's just not something we've been using. And
I love it.
Yeah.
I give so much sub-Q rituximab for patients with mantle cell lymphoma or follicular lymphoma. Mm-hmm. I just give day one IV and then doses 2, 3, and 4 sub-Q, and the patients love it.
Hmm.
I have jumped on the bandwagon.
What about the local reaction, Craig? Because that's the thing I've heard about. Is that much of an issue? Not really?
Not really. I haven't seen much of it. Well, the patients don't complain. Well, I don't ask. It's got to be one of the three things.
So, in a second, we're going to hear about a patient who actually got it. So we'll see what happened with that patient. But I want to get more, though, into the treatment that this patient we're about to hear about actually received, because it's a fairly new treatment. And the answer to this question is because in the past, I think, and still now, a very common first-line treatment for FL when the patient becomes symptomatic is bendamustine rituximab. But what we saw is another trial, we're going through a trial that compared a non-chemotherapy regimen, lenalidomide rituximab, the so-called R-squared regimen. And we'll talk a little bit about the tolerability issues with BR versus so-called R-squared and whether or not you have less toxicity because you're not having chemotherapy. Mike, can you kind of walk through a little bit how they looked at R-squared and what they saw there in this really important study?
Yeah, so there was data in the relapse setting for follicular lymphoma that rituximab and lenalidomide gave a very good response rate, and there's preclinical rationale for that. The drugs in combination enhance the immunotherapy effect of rituximab. And so the combination of lenalidomide and rituximab was used through several induction cycles and then to a lower, somewhat lower dose, longer term follow-up. compared with standard bendamustine rituximab for six cycles. And it turned out in the frontline setting that the bendarutux responses were about the same, really equivalent to R squared. So different side effect profile, somewhat less cytopenia, a little bit more rash and things in the lenalidomide arm. So it gives you the opportunity, instead of having patients coming in for chemotherapy infusions, they can get rituximab like Craig. We often try to switch people over to the sub-Q rituximab after their first infusion is well tolerated. And then it's a quicker treatment. The lenalidomide, of course, is oral. So it's a pretty user-friendly regimen from an administration standpoint.
You know, Molly, I was really surprised because when this trial came out, I guess it was about 2 years ago, and we were anticipating it. We were hearing about this non-chemotherapy alternative. Then it comes out, looks just the same as BR, but not everybody started using it. And even now, I would say, you know, lots of people are getting BR. Others are maybe not even as many getting R squared. And a lot of debate about, is it easier to get BR and maybe not have any maintenance afterwards? Any thoughts about this R squared regimen, Molly? I guess a lot of people bring up the issue. Now you have lenalidomide to deal with. These people often have had or are going to get rituximab. Any comments, Molly?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think that's the interesting part of follicular lymphoma is that there are so many options for therapy. In the two physicians that I work with, one leans towards lenalidomide rituximab because it does seem to be a bit better tolerated. And like you said, there is a bit different side effect profile and then an awful lot of fatigue, right? People on lenalidomide, they get kind of draggy and you have to keep dose reducing and you need to do that. You need to monitor them very closely. A lot of times as you get far out into these regimens, the fatigue and general feeling of malaise is really what limits how much of the lenalidomide you can have a patient take, that what they can tolerate. And then again, some of the dings to their counts too. I think there are people who want to get everything over with. 6 months, 2 days a month, get in and get out, get their BR regimen through with its minimal amount of side effects as well, or its different set of side effects. But there's a lot of neutropenia and a lot of risk for infection in that. So I tend to see more of the oral therapies in general, and adding rituximab in is certainly what seems to be the front runner now is the R squared therapy.
So if you see in your slides, you'll see there's a trial looking at lenalidomide rituximab second line, which people who don't get it first line, I think typically will get it second line. Craig, I'm curious on your take on this. You know, when the data first came out, the lymphoma people were saying, oh, you know, it's kind of challenging to give lenalidomide, et cetera. And then the general oncologists were saying, hey, we give lenalidomide like water for myeloma. We give it for years and we know how to use it. And you have to try to prevent some of those GI problems, et cetera. Craig, any comments on tolerability, BR versus R squared?
I mean, for me and my patients, BR is much better tolerated. I think that exactly what Molly said, there is tremendous fatigue with lenalidomide. I reserve it for first relapse, which I give it quite a bit. It's an unfortunate study, maybe not the best written study, which is why there was no winner take all on that particular protocol. Physicians are very comfortable giving bendamustine or rituximab. We can give it to people who are 90 and older. So I must say I give BR first and hold R squared.
So we're going to talk about, in terms of themes in oncology, the theme of choosing between similar options is one that goes through oncology. That is the art of oncology. We're going to hear about a case in a second of a patient who got R squared, but also got a PI3 kinase inhibitor. I just want to mention quickly, this is a new class of drugs being used. Kind of curious, Mike, what your thoughts are about it. There are now three. You know, this is oncology now. You have new drugs and now you have three of them all of a sudden. Mike, any comments about these three agents, how efficacious they are and how you choose among them?
Yeah, so the B-cell receptor pathway, it's a signaling pathway that's activated in most B-cell malignancies. And we now have this whole family of drugs that target that pathway. So the PI3 kinase inhibitors are among that list. And so the slide you just saw with the three drugs, idelalisib, copanlisib, and duvelisib, the slide's not up for me right now, but there were some highlights on there that were noted in red. And you can see that two of them are oral, one is IV. response rates are pretty comparable. Side effect profile differs a bit across them. There are some class effects, one of which is a concerning toxicity that people who use these are well aware of, and that is that you can see autoimmune side effects that can be delayed until several months into treatment, where they may get, as you can see there on the bottom, a true inflammatory ulcerative colitis type illness. You can see pulmonary inflammation or pneumonitis, and sometimes elevated liver enzymes. So they have different side effect profiles, but you can see here in the results, response rates are reasonable. Complete remissions are pretty unusual, and the durability is not as good as some of the other classes of targeted B-cell receptor pathway inhibitors, but they're active agents. We tend to use nowadays, I think idelalisib is used less because of potentially more propensity to cause some of the inflammatory states that I mentioned, colitis and pneumonitis. So they're important agents for relapsed follicular, not a home run, but useful, and some patients will get meaningful responses from them.
So we're going to finish out this segment on FL by hearing about this patient of Kim's, a 75-year-old. You already referred to her, the fact that she was observed for many years before she required treatment. And when she got treatment, first she got rituximab earlier on, and then later on, or she got R-CHOP, she got R-squared. Maybe you just focus on what happened to her, Kim, when she got the R-squared.
She actually tolerated lenalidomide very well. Initially, though, she had a lot of GI upsets. And once we decreased the dose to 10 milligrams, she has had no further issues. I will say up front, she had a lot of fatigue initially as well. And this is a very active woman. She runs her business, she golfs, and she's a very difficult woman to sit down. And so it was a little bit of a change. Plus, she hadn't been treated for 6 years. She definitely has had a nice response. So she relapsed last July, and that was the initial appearance of the mass. And then this was November. So it's still present, but a lot less. And then we just restaged her this past month, and she continues to have shrinkage in that mass. I didn't have the most recent scan because or had already submitted the film. She's one that does get the rituximab sub-Q. It's more convenient for her. And as of right now, she doesn't have any particular side effects other than mild fatigue. I have to remind her to slow it down a little bit and rest because, like I said, she's one to overdo it. There was a question on there about the financial toxicity of Revlimid or lenalidomide. I think that's one of the biggest challenges we all have with these oral drugs is the cost. And the newer drugs, we can get a lot of grants and stuff for them to help offset the copay. But I think is a factor in treating people is whether or not we can get the lenalidomide at a reasonable cost for them, if what the insurance will cover. So we do focus a lot on that when we decide how we're going to treat patients. But that's something that we, as we all know, we can't lose sight of the cost to the patient. But overall, she's tolerating the treatment well. She's not having any untoward side effects at this point.
So we're going to move on in a second, talk about mantle cell lymphoma. But I just want to show you one scan. We were talking before about the PI3 kinase inhibitors. And Kim, we were going to talk about your 85-year-old man. And you, where the X is, as I should have mentioned before, is where the tumor is. But without getting into detail, you can see here this patient had a good response. So it can occur with these agents, even though they're used pretty late on. So we're going to finish out talking about mantle cell, not as common as some of these other lymphomas, but very important because of all the changes that are occurring. We want to talk about BTK, Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors. There are only three approved in mantle cell. Amazing, the three different agents in the same class. Venetoclax, which we're going to talk a lot about, and BTK inhibitors on Thursday when we talk about CLL. Really, those two strategies revolutionizing CLL. And there are a lot of analogies, I think, between mantle cell and CLL. And lenalidomide also has an important role there. So I'm going to start out with Craig and have you comment on this question or this statement, whether you agree or not. Patients with mantle cell in general have a poor short-term prognosis and require treatment, even if they're asymptomatic. You know, patients read about mantle cell, Craig, on the web, et cetera, come in very, very scared. But my understanding is that some of these, and we were talking about observation, that some of these people can be observed, Craig. Is that the case?
That's true. I would disagree. I would pick B. Let's remember the median age is almost 67 or 68, tend to be men. I think that we're keeping these folks alive for a long period of time now. And in fact, many patients, not many, but there's a minority of patients that are being monitored. The so-called patients that present like CLL with an elevated white count, or the patients who present with polyps in their colon, tend to have lack of genetic abnormality, which we can stain for, and we can monitor those folks. Once again, we have much better treatments than we had a number of years ago. It's an uncommon disease, and we have a ton of drugs that are approved for this disease. And Mike, who is an expert in this disease, I'm sure would agree that many of the new drugs are better than the older drugs. The newer BTK inhibitors are probably better than the older BTK inhibitors. So we're making headway.
You're a futurist, Craig. I like that. So yeah, Mike's got a fantastic presentation. We're going to post it soon. I really recommend it. It goes through a lot of issues about mantle cell. We pulled a couple slides from Mike's presentation. Craig was talking about the fact that it's usually older men. I guess the other thing that's kind of interesting, Mike, is the GI involvement that you see. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, it's remarkable in many ways. Mantle cell lymphoma, unlike most of the others that we've talked about today, really tends to present with extra nodal involvement. So the GI tract is the most common, but it can be in other sites, skin, seen it in prostate, periorbital, etc. But there seems to be a real tropism for mantle cell lymphoma and the GI tract. So if you do colonoscopies on everyone newly diagnosed with mantle cell, even if they don't have polyps and it looks like normal mucosa, and you biopsy that, about 65-70% of folks will have infiltration of their GI mucosa with mantle cell. So it's part of the disease, and fortunately, although it can lead to bleeding or rarely perforation, but it's something to be aware of when we're initiating treatment for patients with advanced mantle cell.
So again, someone I noticed in the chat room asked about the slides. They're on the app, and we're also emailing them to you. We're going to talk a little bit about the use of novel agents in mantle cell, often given second line. People often get chemoimmunotherapy first line, but the real question is, what do you do next? And Kim, we know that almost when we ask this question, oncologists, almost everybody will say a BTK inhibitor comes next, but they might argue a little bit about which one. Before we kind of get into how BTK inhibitors work, Kim, just kind of curious what your experience is in terms of tolerability. We have ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, we have zanubrutinib, although it's pretty new. Any comments, Kim, in terms of what you see in these patients?
Well, I mean, I've used those drugs in CLL. Now I've used them in lymphoma, even used them in leukemia. And clearly, we have to look at the patient's comorbidities. Overall, I think they tolerate them very well. I think people tend, in my experience, tolerate venetoclax better than like ibrutinib. I think there's less side effects. And some people have no problems with ibrutinib, but it seems like everybody has one little side effect or another with ibrutinib, and they tend to get better the longer they're on the drug. So I just kind of coach them along to try to get through the first few months. A lot of the side effects seem to be similar with each patient, but overall, people do tolerate because, especially like with the other, like CLL, they're on it for a long time, and they seem to tolerate it fairly well. And we also talk about the cytopenias with the drug. Most everyone does well. We find that venetoclax tends to affect the blood counts a little bit more than ibrutinib. So it seems to me they tolerate it much better than chemotherapy.
So Craig, maybe you can talk a little bit about the way BTK inhibitors work, or theoretically why they help patients with mantle cell as well as other diseases. And again, your take on why one is different than the other.
So in general, if you just look at this schema, the BCR means the B-cell receptor, and you can see where BTK is. And the B-cell receptor is turned on in many types of lymphoma and in CLL, where ibrutinib inhibits BTK, which is distal or below the B-cell receptor. So this pathway tends to be turned off. And I have an interesting anecdote. When ibrutinib came out, it was the single best agent I'd ever seen in any cancer that I took care of. And we had a study that was opened with ibrutinib. I had a patient with CLL who had tremendous disease burden. We had to give him the pill in clinic, and he called 20 minutes later. He was on the George Washington Bridge, and he said, "Doc, all my lymph nodes have gone away." So now that doesn't necessarily happen in mantle cell lymphoma, but it can. I, for one, firmly believe that acalabrutinib is less toxic than ibrutinib. And I suspect, after looking at the data that has just been reported at ASCO, I don't have as much familiarity with zanubrutinib, but we do have studies open, that zanubrutinib will probably be less toxic than the other two. And maybe Mike can comment. But ibrutinib definitely needs to be respected. It is the first, and it was great. But now we have variations on the theme. So I think that we'll see its use wane with the newer drugs.
And I am curious what Mike's take on this is. And when you look at this, here's a waterfall plot using one of these, acalabrutinib. And again, we talked about before, going down is good. The tumor's getting smaller. And you can see how effective these drugs are. You were mentioning acalabrutinib also. I guess one thing that's kind of interesting, Molly, I started hearing about this when acalabrutinib came out. I'm like, really? Was the headache.
Yeah.
It's like I kept hearing this story, well, you have to drink a cup of coffee and then it goes away. Is that kind of the way it works, Molly?
Yes, actually, it is kind of the way it works. And it's noticeable enough, or it happens frequently enough, that people bring it up. And these are people who aren't headache people. And that's, we always ask people, is this your normal headache? Or is this, you know, do you normally get headaches? Do you normally suffer like this? And they say no. And it's truly temporal to the dosing. And so caffeine, for better or worse, helps get these through. And it's a pretty benign approach to fixing a side effect. But it's fairly common with this drug.
So, Mike, we're going to be talking a lot about so-called tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And, for example, in our lung cancer program, there's several that target EGFR. Can you talk a little bit, Mike, about what a TKI is and why TKIs in the same class might have different toxicities, even different efficacy?
Well, so one of the ways that our cellular biology works is by turning on or turning off proteins and molecules in cells as cells grow, or in some cases they are turned on inappropriately, like the B cell receptor pathway, and they're sort of driving the malignancy to proliferate and to persist. And so what it really does at a cellular level or a molecular level is that the kinase puts tyrosine residues onto other proteins that then either upregulate or downregulate them. So interfering with those can sort of cripple a cell's machinery that they depend upon to persist. So they can be very active. And some of the side effects you've been hearing about depend on, it's not so much the effect of, say, ibrutinib on ibrutin tyrosine kinase inhibition, but it hits other kinases as well. So that's the off-target effect that you see, not just with these drugs, but all of the ones that Neil's referring to. And so hitting kinases that aren't relevant to the cancer can give you side effects that don't really put you any closer to getting your disease in remission. I would make one other comment about the fact that we have so many of these oral drugs, and I think I mentioned it in my talk that you'll be able to download, and that is that nurses are so critically important to monitoring and helping manage patients on these chronic oral therapies. They're chemo-free, but they're not toxicity-free, and we're learning as people are on them for a year or two or three that they can develop late side effects. And so it's very important that our nurses in the clinic and in the infusion centers, et cetera, are aware of side effects and that they make sure that we're doing a good job of managing and identifying side effects of these drugs so that patients can continue to benefit from the improved outcomes that you've heard about.
And again, one of the themes that we're going to be talking about is adherence, and particularly to oral agents, Kim. And again, just kind of curious, you know, people kind of assumed if you have cancer, you're going to take your meds. But I think initially we saw this with tamoxifen and breast cancer seemed to be, you know, a relatively easy drug to take, but yet lots of people ended up not taking it. Kim, any comments about what you do to try to assess and maximize adherence?
Yeah, oral adherence is a huge problem. We do involve our pharmacist, who does a wonderful job of educating the patient as well. We try to provide calendars, and we have to keep a pretty close eye on refills, because a lot of times we find out, we think the patient is compliant, and then we come to find out they haven't filled their prescription for 2 months if we haven't seen them. But we have to be on the patients all the time, and we always reinforce compliance with each visit, and we try to follow up with them if we don't see them that often to make sure they're still taking their medicines, to make sure they're not having any untoward side effects. But compliance is a huge problem, but we just do our best on our end to educate and to monitor and keep following up with these patients.
So we're going to finish
Molly,
out with
what your experiences.
Well, maybe we can get into that briefly with this case here, Molly. I would mention also, when we post these presentations, they're going to have a lot more about these cases. They're really in-depth presentations. Here, we're just kind of giving you a little bit of a flavor. And Molly, this is an unusual situation of a man. Really, he's been on ibrutinib for a long time. He's really done probably better than a lot of patients with mantle cell would do. Just maybe from 10,000 feet, so to speak, how do you view him?
Yeah, he's an exception to the rule. I always like to think of him. He's about the right age. He's 72. He's a male, diagnosed, and his frontline treatment was ibrutinib rather than chemotherapy or a combination of therapy. And he was adamant that he did not want to have any type of chemotherapy. He's a farmer. He's a cattle farmer with 80 plus acres and a couple hundred head of cattle. And so he's going and doing and busy. And really, he probably had disease a lot longer than we knew about it, because it took him a while to get to the doctor. But ibrutinib was given as a frontline therapy, and he did well. Initially, he had neutropenia, came into the hospital. You know, I always use this scenario, you got to clean out the garden to get the good stuff to grow. And so his bone marrow was positive. And so when you start cleaning things out with the ibrutinib, then things are left. He doesn't have any good cells, and you've got a backlog before his bone marrow can regenerate those. So he did have neutropenic fever. He got started on some IV immunoglobulins as well. And then a couple of years later, he had a sinus infection that, because he was a farmer and here in the Midwest and all the dust, we were worried that he had a fungal infection, and he had CAT scans and biopsies and had to have his sinuses cleaned out. But fortunately, there was no mucor, no fungus infection. He just had anatomy that was causing him to have frequent recurrent sinus infections. And so one of the things we have to do is have folks hold their ibrutinib prior to a surgery because of the risk of bleeding, and depending on how involved the bleeding is. And so sometimes they don't tell there are other physicians who are going to do surgeries because that's not part of what they're doing. And, well, I take a pill for my cancer, but that, and so it's a lot of upfront education. If you ever have to have a surgery, you have to let us know. If you're ever going to have a procedure, we need to know so we can help you, you know, figure out how long you have to hold it. And he did well. Once he got his sinuses cleaned out, he's still cruising, still farming, doing well.
And you were telling me he's resisting retirement.
He is. He says he's retired, but he's not. His son is running the farm, but he's not. The son is running the farm with the father as the whipcracker, and this is what we're going to do. But we're trying to get him to retire and let him enjoy life, because who knows what this run is going to be on the ibrutinib. And I don't know that he'll want to do something else.
We should emphasize that this is certainly not typical therapy. It's off-label. Was given first line because he refused to take anything else. And sounds like he's done really well. We're going to talk a lot more about BTK inhibitors on Thursday and venetoclax. We're going to talk about that with mantle cell, but we're going to bring venetoclax back up. It is an important part of mantle cell. We're going to talk about that on Thursday as well. Just want to finish out with a couple of comments related to management of lymphomas in the era of COVID. And I'm going to go back to Craig in a second, because Craig was at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, and certainly New York has been the epicenter of COVID right now. I'm curious what's been going on in your colleagues, but thought you might find this interesting. So this is from our survey of the registrants from all over the country. I should mention, we list in the slides a whole bunch of resources about management of lymphomas in the COVID era. So check the slides to check out these things. We have some pretty simple questions. You know, a lot of people say, well, I live in whatever rural area, we haven't been that affected, et cetera. Except when we ask them questions like this, you really realize how medical care and oncologic care has changed so quickly and so dramatically, Craig. So we said, are you, and this is from nurses across the country, are you restricting number of visitors? 94%, yes. Are your healthcare workers wearing masks and PPE? 100%, yes. Patients who visit your clinic required PPE, 98%. This is another thing I thought was interesting. We were talking about this last week, telemedicine and talking to patients through that vehicle. We asked people, when you use telemedicine, are you spending more or less time with them than when you see them in person? And interestingly, about half the people estimate that they spend about the same amount of time, but the other half, most of them say they're spending a little bit less time, averaging about 20 minutes. Craig, just some maybe closing thoughts about these and how things have changed around the country, and also what you're hearing from your former colleagues in New York.
Well, I feel terrible that patients can't have their family members with them to get chemotherapy. That is just awful. And I make it a big deal when I speak to a patient the first time when they're getting chemotherapy, never get chemotherapy without somebody coming with you and have a note taker. And now nobody can come. And I sometimes, if it's not a savvy patient, they're like, some of them look a little clueless, quite frankly. Yeah. So the nursing is even more important with that. You know, the patients in the hospital, you know, nobody can go and see them. The family members are not there. I think it has dramatically changed the way that we are taking care of our oncologic patients. I'm definitely spending less time on telemedicine than a face-to-face patient. Now, the whole telemedicine visit may be longer until the patients can sign on and do what they need to do and speak with the nurses. But my face-to-face time, I think, is a little bit less. But I am choosing patients to be on telemedicine that are pretty straightforward. And what we started this week on the 1st, on Monday, is physicians will be in the office for 4 hours, hour break, and then 4 hours telemedicine. And we all had to have a separate day for another telemedicine day. So we're looking at about probably a quarter to a third of in-person visits, and everybody else is telemedicine. At Sloan Kettering, everybody is pretty much telemedicine. And just to speak a little bit about Memorial for a minute, folks, I'm going to be 61. Nobody my age is going in to see patients in the hospital. All the younger physicians are seeing the folks. It's very hard to see your patients who are ill. It's demoralizing to me. I can just imagine how the patients feel. Sorry to expound on that, but I wonder what the other folks have to say.
Well, I think we're going to maybe table that. I will say that our new podcast, Oncology Today, if you go to your typical podcast provider, Apple, look for Oncology Today. Kelly Goodwin, who's a nurse practitioner in MGH, is on our new program talking about how they set up a COVID unit in their cancer center at MGH. Really interesting. Kelly is going to be on our metastatic lung cancer program June 11th. We call these oncology rounds because there's no beginning or end. It's like every other round. 10 o'clock, you're done. You go back to work. Hopefully, you thought of 50 questions you wish you had the answer to, and you know maybe we'll get to them next time. But thank you all so much for participating tonight. Thanks so much to the faculty. Be safe and stay well.